attacked by militants, but no one was hurt. Balochistan has been badly affected by quake, leaving 21,000 families homeless and over 40,000 square kilometers of roads destroyed. Most of the victims are still waiting for government relief. Abdul Sattar, NPR News, Islamabad.
The government says consumer spending increased in August. The Commerce Department says it was up 0.3%. Consumer spending makes up about 2/3 of the U.S. economy. Federal authorities have arrested two Colorado farmers in connection with a deadly listeria outbreak in 2011. 33 people died after eating tainted cantaloupe traced to that farm. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Charles Schwab, working to help investors take control of their financial future. Charles Schwab, own your tomorrow. Learn more at schwab.com.
Today's programming is made possible by Silver Creek in downtown Urbana, serving lunch and dinner every day with a brunch on Sunday. For over 20 years, Silver Creek has served fresh and seasonally current dinners by the fireplace in warm wood ambience. Silver Creek offers over 100 fine wines and draft beers.
Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Kim Stanley Robinson has been writing science fiction for about 30 years. He's been finding his characters in the past, present, and future on other planets and here on Earth. He's written in various ways about the Black Death, colonizing the planet Mars, the impact of global warming, and three possible futures for Orange County, California, which is where I understand you grew up and you live today. And you've done well in the genre. You've made the New York Times bestseller list. You've won awards such as the Hugos and the Nebulas. A lot of research goes into Stan Robinson's fiction, along with a certain amount of personal experience. Even, I'm gathering, in his latest novel, which involves a teenage boy's initiation as a shaman in Europe more than 30,000 years ago. And so we'll try to figure that out as we welcome Kim Stanley Robinson to Focus this morning. Stan, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Jim. It's great to be here.
Now, you're here this week for a symposium on science fiction and the arts and humanities, and you gave the keynote address yesterday.
Yeah, that's right.
And tell me, can you talk about the basic theme that you were working on in that talk?
Sure. It was really a pleasure because a lot of my talks in the last 10 years or so have been devoted to policy issues and often climate change, because that's what my Washington, D.C. books of the earlier part of this decade were about. And this time it was about science fiction about the arts and the future of the arts, and also science fiction as an art form, what it is, how it works. So it was really fun to just get back to the literary side of what I do.
I just want to note your questions for Kim Stanley Robinson are welcome. Our toll-free number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And we also welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Talking about art, or the role that artistic expression as a subject matter, perhaps, can play in a book, I'm looking at your latest novel, Shaman, which I understand was inspired in part by the cave paintings found at the, I'm going to try to pronounce this right, the Chauvet Cave in France.
Yep, that's right. In 1995, they found a new painted cave in France, and the paintings were as beautiful as any that have ever been found. And then they dated the paints and found that this cave had been painted 32,000 years ago, which makes it almost twice as old as caves like Lascaux and Altamira, and the oldest painted caves that we know of. So I was fascinated by that, and I've always been interested in how we lived during the Paleolithic, when human beings kind of came into themselves as, you know, individuals and as a society and culture. So I thought it would make a kind of a science fiction story to go backwards rather than forwards and describe what those people were living like when they painted the cave, and even describe the painting of the cave itself in some detail. So it's an adventure story. It's a small group of people surviving on an icy planet. But in fact, in this case, it really did happen, and the paintings are really there to be referenced.
It's in a sense your job to figure out as a writer how these what these people are doing the painting for.
Yes, that's right. And here I rely, as I always do, on what the scientists are saying about it. This book could not have been written without the work of the archaeologists and the anthropologists. And there's two ways that they go about it. One, they look at the artifacts themselves and try to deduce from them what the culture was like and what the people were thinking. That's hard. And then also they go to look at various first people cultures around the world today that if when you look at them when they were first encountered by Western civilization, you can backtrack and deduce that, that their life ways probably had a fairly long history, so that the way that they were living in the 19th century when we first encountered them is probably the way that they had been living for thousands of years. And so you have to, in both cases, you have to do guesswork. So these sciences are made by inference and by guesswork, and I ran with that. They have to stick to what they can defend, and me writing a novel can go further than that and say, I'm trying to be realistic here, but what I have to do is make the imaginative leap and say, given what we've known, this is the way they must have been living. And it would have been very exciting, very difficult, really an achievement to have a culture last for literally thousands of years and stay alive on a planet where we didn't have much in the way of resources, energy, or power as opposed to the other big animals that were around at the time.
Was there a way that your personal experience was useful in this novel?
Yes, to a limited extent. I mean, I really don't know what the Paleolithic was like myself. I am definitely a modern person. But I spend a lot of my recreational time backpacking in the Sierra Nevada of California, and a fair amount of that backpacking includes snow camping. And I'm a terrible skier, and so my snow camping, along with my friends, has been on snowshoes. And snowshoes are a very ancient technology, really predates skiing by a long shot. And I've spent a fair amount of time out there in the snow trying to stay dry, warm, comfortable, and fed. And so that gave me some sense of what it must have been like for humans living in the Ice Age with only the stuff that they could carry on their back. It made me more and more impressed by what they managed to do.
Although I should note, I was just peeking at some of the pages. You can go to Amazon.com and read a sample from Kim Stanley Robinson's new novel, Shaman. And you essentially start by taking your teenage protagonist and thrusting him out naked into the cold for his shamanistic vision quest initiation, and he's just trying to stay alive out there.
Yes, that's right. That's the start of the book. And the strongest theory now for what those cave paintings were about and why people were doing them was that they were part of shaman practices. And so they had an animal magic or an animal religion involved, because they're paintings of animals, but only of certain kinds of animals and in certain positions. And there are other abstract paintings beside them that are suggestive that it was a shaman culture. So the initiations for young shamans who are about to get into the business, so to speak, were what the Australian Aborigines called a walkabout. You were sent out on your own, and you were and often naked to prove it was an initiation ceremony. It was like a bar mitzvah in a way, where you go out there and prove that you can get by in the world on your own and not just survive but even prosper and do well. And it's a matter of technique. It's an expertise that everybody would have learned at that time, but it's an extreme case to be cast out there with nothing, because then you actually have to clothe yourself, find food, and get fire going from scratch. And all these are possible. It's just that they're difficult, and there's a skill set that you need there in order to survive, and it's sort of proof of concept that you can do it.
Your experience just, you know, tramping out in the cold in snowshoes, I would imagine just gives you the sort of tactile experience that you can transmit in the novel. And, you know, a lot of people must wonder, you know, in science fiction, where you're going so many places that people are not going to go and having experiences that people are not going to have, is it still possible to get that immediate tactile experience and work it into a book somehow?
Well, that's a great question, because that's really the whole trick of the game. Science fiction going off into unknown worlds, histories that we can't possibly know yet because they're set in the future or in an alternative past, Well, the whole reason we read novels is to have a sense that we're in other lives and we're managing to overhear other people's thoughts. It's a kind of a telepathy, and then also a cultural experience where you get to live in other life ways at different times. And that's the joy of novels, but it depends on specificity and on a sense that the novel knows what it's talking about. And that depends on sensory details and the kind of things that you could only know if you had been there yourself. And the novelist in science fiction cases has often not been there themselves. So this is a problem, a technical problem, in the writing of a science fiction novel and making it still solid, is one way to put it, or a reading experience like any other novel. And you have to call on what you have experienced and stick it into the context of what you haven't experienced, at least is how I find it. So the anything that I have done in my life, which has basically been a suburban Mr. Mom, you know, with hobbies of gardening and backpacking, well, my books often feature, you know, parenting, gardening, and backpacking one way or another. And I have to find plots that will allow me to talk about the things that I know, even if they happen to be on Mars or if they happen to be in 30,000 years in the past. Or one of my bigger projects was to try to describe the world if all of the Europeans had died in the Black Death in the around the year 1400. What would the world be like without us? And there I had to once again think about what I did know and put it into this world that was dominated by Asia and Africa. And so these are the kind of things that I have to think about when I'm doing science fiction.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking with science fiction author Kim Stanley Robinson, and his latest novel is Shaman, a novel of the Ice Age from Orbit Books. He's at the U of I campus for a symposium on science fiction and the humanities, and I believe at 11:30 this morning you'll be taking part and a panel on science fiction and music.
That's right.
And that's at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus this morning at 11:30. Our phone number, if you want to call us, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL. Our email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. I was wondering, some writers of science fiction chafe at being labeled science fiction writers. I always thought the late Kurt Vonnegut Jr. was someone who ran away from the title.
Yep.
And you seem to embrace it. You seem quite happy in the idea of science fiction as a specific genre.
Yes, I would say I'm a kind of genre patriot. I write science fiction, and I'm proud of it. And I think it's a beautiful art form amongst the rest of the art forms. And it's a strange choice even to me, but what I think happened was I actually was born in Illinois in Waukegan, grew up in Zion, Illinois, and so this is the same as Ray Bradbury, moved to Southern California when my parents moved there. In my case, I was even younger than Bradbury. I was like four. So Southern California when I was a child was all orange groves. And avocado groves and lemon groves. And I lived out in the backwoods, and I thought that I was Huckleberry Finn, and I was living in Huckleberry Finn's situation, which was deeply wrong, but I didn't know that being a kid. And while I was a youth, Orange County and Southern California more generally was utterly transformed into the concrete and freeway and condominium complex that it is now, a rather dreadful landscape in human terms. And I watched that happen, and then I went off to college. I didn't think much about it as a kid, but I ran into science fiction at that moment, and science fiction seemed right to me. It seemed like it was the only literature that I had ever run into and read that spoke to my own experience as an American in the world we're in right now. So what I will assert, and I think is true, is that science fiction is the realism of our time. Modern industrial America is a science fiction complex. It's a science fiction novel that we all co-author together. And this is why science fiction dominates the movies and why it's a literature that young people in particular love to read, because it speaks to them. It's the world that we live in. Science is changing everything so fast that the only literature that captures that feeling is science fiction, to my mind. So I've been committed to it for, at this point, it's nearly 40 years, hard to believe. But what I've seen is that I think my original youthful intuition was correct, because more and more the world seems to me like a near-future science fiction novel that we're all inhabiting together. And none of us can predict with any certainty at all in 5 years what technology we're going to be using and how it's going to have changed our habits. We know it's going to be different. We don't know how it's going to be different. The only way to get oriented to that experience is to be reading science fiction and thinking about it.
And I'm wondering, you know, one thing I think of is the entire, you know, revolution in communications led by personal computers and networked computers.
Yep.
Is something that I wouldn't have imagined, at least not in that way, when I was a kid. A lot of science fiction writers didn't seem to imagine it. When they thought of computers, they seemed to think of essentially big, threatening artificial intelligences and not these useful tools which seem to surround us.
Yes. In fact, this is kind of a famous gap in science fiction's predictive powers, because by and large, most of the things that happened in the 20th century had been pretty well predicted by the science fiction before it, but not the personal computer. And all I can say is that the personal computer is quite surprising, that really it looked like computers were going to have to take up something like what we're sitting in right now. A radio studio with all of the machinery and all of the blinking lights would have been one computer, and the fact that my wristwatch here is actually a computer as powerful as the apparatus in this room is really a shocking thing. Essentially, the chip was something that science fiction couldn't predict. But I will say that Illinois' own Ray Bradbury predicted reality TV in a sense around living room complex where the TV surrounded you and so did the sound, and the people on the TV were interacting with you as an individual, and that's all in Fahrenheit 451. So in 1950, by looking at those first tiny little black and white TVs, Bradbury managed to intuit the whole entertainment complex that we live in right now. So that's a rather spectacularly successful predictive act in communications and in modern life.
And that's interesting also because, you know, some science fiction writers really come from scientific backgrounds and pay attention to scientific developments, and I think you do to that to some extent. And Ray Bradbury was really more of a poet, and
yeah. He
didn't really care, for instance, in the Martian Chronicles, whether or not he was describing a Mars that could ever actually exist. But here, in terms of how people use technology, he got something very close to right.
Yes, and I mean, I'm an English major myself. I'm not a scientific person, and I think science fiction is not really about the details of the sciences, but how society is going to use technology. And that's where Bradbury was particularly good. I mean, he didn't even like cars. He didn't fly. And, of course, being in Los Angeles most of his life, not liking cars was a real disadvantage to him.
There's a famous companion story to Fahrenheit 451 called The Pedestrian, in which essentially man gets arrested for taking a walk in Los Angeles.
Yeah, well, you do look odd. Walking one of those really long avenues in Los Angeles, it's not a pedestrian architecture. And so there were very few people doing it, and you would be a suspicious character. So it's a joke, but it's also true.
And in your own fiction, we're talking about science fiction. Is there a price to being a science fiction writer in the material sense? I've heard some writers complain about the genre as a ghetto and it affects either the recognition you get or actually the money you make. Is that true? Mm-hmm. Is that true today like it was, say, 50 years ago?
Well, no, it's not true, and the situation is much better now than it's ever been before. And I think the way to conceptualize it is that every kind of fiction is a genre, but what happens is at the top of every genre, it's almost like a capital E. The most successful books in any genre fall into a new genre called the bestseller. And once you're a bestseller, you have transcended whatever your original genre was, so that Stephen King is a horror writer, but actually he's a bestseller. Sue Grafton writes mysteries, but actually she's a bestseller. Science fiction had, you know, Isaac Asimov or Frank Herbert. They're science fiction writers, but in the end, they were basically bestsellers. And that's how the publishing industry works. within any of the genres, you can scale up or down. It tends to go by magnitudes, where if you're doing a little bit better, you're actually doing 10 times better.
What was the first book you wrote that was considered to be a bestseller?
Well, I've been my whole life, as Thomas Hardy said, more of a long seller than a bestseller, in that my books have had long lifetimes without ever at any moment selling enough to make the bestseller list until just last year with 2312. So that was quite a pleasant surprise. But what I will say is that my book Red Mars and my Mars trilogy, they outsold anything I'd done previously to that, and they became what I guess you could call a little bestseller. And they continued to sell, so that they're both a little bestseller in their own moment, and then they've done better and better. The internet helps with this, and the idea of Mars helps with this. So really, my Mars books, that's really what turned me from being one of the many writers in the science fiction world that I think do very interesting, beautiful work, to someone who has a better connection with the general culture, that if people are going to read science fiction, they've often read the Mars books.
So is there a threshold that gets crossed there as far as how many people, you know, how wide a range of people access your work and who pays attention to it?
I think that's right. There's a kind of a cascade of information, and if everybody is telling five people, you've just got to read this book, and if that catches fire, it's sort of like a forest fire. There's a moment that comes where there's a burst of interest in your work. Word of mouth. This is the whole thing in publishing, and this is a cliche or a truism in publishing. The only thing that really works is word of mouth, is readers talking to other readers who trust them. So that advertising doesn't quite work, reviews don't quite work, radio shows like this don't quite work. What works is readers talking to other readers. And that's, of course, mysterious. What kind of novel hits someone so hard that they have to tell their five best reading friends, you just have to read this one, you'll love it? Well, that's a mysterious thing.
It must feel strange to be the person that someone is doing that about your work, because there was a time when they weren't.
Yeah.
And now they are.
Well, it's a very beautiful feeling, I have to say, because the thing is, I love to read myself. That's more or less my religion, my chief recreation. It's really been my life. I'm a literary person. I don't care about movies, for instance. What I like to do is settle down with a novel and go there and have that reading experience where I'm gone or the novel is happening in my head, and I've lived 10,000 lives because I like to read novels. And so to know that there are some other people for whom my book has had given them that experience of being gone, and of, you know, they've been on Mars, they've lived with my characters on Mars for 100 years or so, well, this is, it's a lovely feeling.
Are there writers, or could you tell me which writers are the ones that you feel the need to go tell five friends about when you first encountered them?
Sure. We were just talking about one of them, which is Illinois' own Gene Wolfe, long-term resident of Barrington, Illinois, and now down in Peoria often. Well, his works have, as anybody who loves his works will tell you, they are mesmerizing, and you can really go deep and into a very strange and beautiful fictional space with Gene Wolfe stories.
And maybe to throw out some titles, The Book of the New Sun and the various follow-ups to that.
Yeah. The Fifth Head of Cerberus, Free Live Free, which is a really almost any Gene Wolfe title will be a marvelous experience.
One thing I think about, having read a little of him himself, is just there's a little knot of short stories playing on the variants of this pulp magazine title. The Island of Dr. Death, the Death of Dr. Island, and I think there was a third one.
And the Doctor of Death Island, yes. Gene's got a kind of peculiar and hilarious sense of humor. And so he's played a lot of tricky games with the story suites that connect up to each other in unusual ways. He's probably one of the more inventive writers in America alive today in terms of thinking up new things to do that other people have never thought of.
But I don't know, has he crossed that bestseller threshold?
Well, his Book of the New Sun, I think, was widely read by people who love to read fantasy.
And I should say that this is, I think, four volumes in this case. Mm-hmm. And then there were some follow-up works as well, going to several more volumes.
Well, that one, if you get started and you love the Book of the New Sun, you're in a good space because it goes on into further adventures that I think ultimately add up to almost a dozen volumes. But they're clustered so that you can kind of go individually into them. But yes, that's been the major work of his life.
Do you see is there a particular theme or approach to the subject that makes the Book of the New Sun special, that influenced you?
Well, that's a good question. That book is so singular. But I guess what I would take out of the Book of the New Sun is, in that case, it happens somewhere in South America about maybe a million years from now. So it's in the genre we call science fantasy, because so many things have happened that humanity has gained some magical powers but have forgotten how it has them, so that it lives in a strange kind of post-historical state that is somewhat like a fantasy novel, but it's still supposedly connected to our history. And what I realized is that in a novel like that, you set up your own rules. It has its own mythology, and what you can do is give the reader what in science fiction we call world building, that you don't just have characters and a plot, but you also have a world with its own integrity, and people get to live in that world. And it has to reflect this one, of course, because we're all human. We only can imagine so much amount of difference, and besides which, we're only interested in a certain amount of difference. But in this case, what he talked about in that book was the so-called Book of Gold, the book that matters to you more than any other, that kind of formed you when you were young. And I think his Book of the New Sun served as that for a certain number of readers. And I think that my Mars trilogy has served that way for a certain number of readers, that the world building is crucial to those big, long novels.
Well, I'm going to take a short break right here, and we'll be back in a moment with more in a conversation with science fiction writer Kim Stanley Robinson on Focus on WILL.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe serves breakfast and lunch from 8 a.m. to 1 p.m. Monday through Friday. Daily menus are available online at bevercafe.illinois.edu. Bevere offers Wi-Fi and is staffed and managed by students. Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
The new season of community cinema at a new location, the Spurlock Museum on the U of I campus. Our first film, The Graduates, Los Graduados, explores pressing issues in education through the eyes of six Latino and Latina students from across the United States, offering firsthand perspectives on the barriers they have to overcome to make their dreams come true. Join us for the free public screening at the Knight Auditorium of the Spurlock Museum Tuesday, October 1st from 7 to 9:30 p.m.
We're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and I'm talking with science fiction author Kim Stanley Robinson. He's on the U of I campus for a symposium on science fiction and the humanities. He'll be taking part in a panel on science fiction and music at 11:30 on campus at the Levis Faculty Center. Give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. If you have any questions for Stan. And we were talking just a moment ago about Gene Wolfe's Book of the New Sun as being really a book that had a big influence on you. You described the work as the type of science fiction or fantasy that takes place in the very far future. Mm-hmm. But I believe you were in your talk yesterday as part of the symposium here on campus, talking about your own work as being in a different area, looking at really something a little closer in the future, where you can really extrapolate from some things that are being thought about now.
Yeah, that's right. And yesterday and recently, I've been making this distinction that is somewhat new in my own thinking, trying to understand what science fiction does. I realized that there were really very distinctly different kinds of science fiction that depend on how far out into the future you're putting your story space. So that I talked about space opera, which everybody knows from Star Trek and Star Wars, and space opera was a kind of 1930s invention, is out there in the galaxy, and it's so far in the future that you don't really put a date on it because it's transcended dating, and it's past the history that we could keep track of.
And even Star Wars, you know, officially it takes place long ago and far away. It's sort of outside of any time.
Right. It's kind of a joke to say long ago, as if humans were, you know, it's a strange statement to make. But part of the jokiness of the first Star Wars was that the space operas of the 1930s were kind of silly. And the wonderful thing about the first Star Wars movie that was lost in the later ones was that it was meant to be hilarious, and it was. It was a spoof on what science fiction was like that was not dissimilar to Mel Brooks's spoofs.
Really, considering Mel Brooks later did a spoof of that whole genre.
That's right, but that's because Star Wars began to take itself way too seriously and become portentous in an attempt to pretend that it was saying serious things about politics.
I know after the first Star Wars movie came out, there were so many articles I read, and I think George Lucas fed this about the mythic themes that Star Wars took on, and it sounded very serious. I mean, a lot of fun, but still very serious. But you're saying that actually this was really more lighthearted.
Well, you can, because Joseph Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces is such a gigantic abstraction from actual stories, you can fit almost any story of a young man coming into his own into the Joseph Campbell mythological framework, and that's what you can do with Star Wars. But in fact, the original movie is like Buck Rogers in the year 2500, which is a movie that came out, say, a year or two before. Just a very silly romp making fun of what science fiction was doing.
Was Buck Rogers, was the Flash Gordon?
Well, there was a movie, there was a spoof movie. I thought it was called Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, and it was like Flash Gordon, and it was there was Kentucky Fried Movie that was sort of science fictional. There was, in the mid-70s, early 70s, there were some extremely silly, spacey comedies that were somewhat like Mel Brooks and Star Wars fit into that because everything that went on in the first Star Wars was done with a sense of humor and had a sense of unreality about it. I mean, the stormtroopers would shoot 50,000 lasers and miss every time, and the good guys would shoot one and it would work. And all this was meant to be funny. And the fact that Princess Leia was a smartass and was making fun of everybody else and was feisty, this was a neat reversal on the poor, pitiful me heroine of earlier space operas.
And so perhaps, for some reason, I remember from the first movie just the way that Alec Guinness said the word evil. Actually, he said evil.
Yes.
And I thought that's an interesting choice there. Is that perhaps a hint that he's not taking it totally seriously?
Alec Guinness could barely believe the lines he was reading in that movie. He told people much, much later. But the thing is that it was a successful movie because it was so funny and it wasn't taking itself seriously. And so this is really what space opera was all about, and it is a great play space. So, okay, that's space opera, and what you're in rocket ships, you can go faster than the speed of light, the galaxy is your playground. In a way, it's like any other fantasy novel, and its pretense to be based on technology is almost entirely made up because the technologies are so magical. But there's another kind of science fiction, which you can call near future science fiction or the day after tomorrow. And that's the kind of books that you see out of people like William Gibson or Neal Stephenson, very popular books, where it's almost like today, but certain features have been pushed. Government has even more power. Businesses have even more power. People have more technological home do-it-yourself type abilities to change their machines or their bodies, which tend to begin to merge together. So near future science fiction is never dated because it's sort of like right now plus, and it's a symbolic space where what's going on right now has been exaggerated and looks a little bit like a fever dream of the current moment. Well, this is an interesting way to write about right now, and I would say that near future science fiction is today's best realism, in that it's the literature that's capturing best the way that life feels for us right now, with the technology changing everything every 5 years, as I was saying before. So there's near future science fiction, and then there's space opera. We call them both science fiction, and yet they're radically different in their fields. Near future tends to be a little dystopian, a little pessimistic, a little bit scary and gritty, real. Space opera tends to be utopian and playful because it's assuming that we've gotten to the age of spaceships and life extension and zipping around the galaxy. And then in between those two is the zone that I've been working in most of my career, which I call future history, because it tends to be dated. It tends to explain how we got from now to the world that's being described in the novel, which will be sort of in the solar system. The science will be plausible. It will be an extension of engineering techniques that we already have now. So there won't be faster than light travel, and there won't be miraculous things going on. It's more an experimental space where you think about, if we continue to do what we're doing right now, we could get to this kind of a society and this kind of a culture. And so there are fewer science fiction novels of this kind, and yet they are often amongst the most interesting and famous. When 1984 was written, for instance, and there's the date right in the title, it was 1948, and those developments that Orwell talked about, which were, of course, very negative, were still far enough out there that he could give you a history in his book that got you from the world of the reader to the world of the text. And that's a kind of science fiction I call future history, because it's so very historical. It's trying to say, if we do X, we'll get to Y, and let's think about that. And maybe we will want to do A and get to B instead. So it's very much a matter of choices, and it's a sort of a sociology of the future.
I'm thinking of your Mars trilogy now, where you've got people going to colonize Mars. So
yes.
It sounds like we've solved a few immediate, though perhaps very important, technological problems, and now you're looking at the next part and actually trying to make a permanent human settlement on the planet Mars, which actually goes beyond just a settlement in the terraforming the planet, et cetera.
Yeah, that's right.
What did you decide was the reason people had to go to Mars?
Well, in the book, what was going on was the American and Russian space programs were becoming obsolete, and America and Russia together realized that they were being overtaken economically and in terms of sheer numbers of people in Earth geopolitics by China and India. And they decided that one of the things they could do as a remnant of the Cold War, because I wrote these books in the 90s, was to put their programs together and go and start a settlement on Mars just as a kind of venture, an enterprise to see if we could inhabit Mars and what might happen from that. So it was a kind of extension of the space program thinking of the Apollo era. And then when they got to Mars, they found that there's enough water on Mars, which there is, that if you brought the water to the surface and began to heat the planet up, you could terraform Mars and you could turn it into essentially a kind of second Earth, although it would always remain a very cold and, you might say, Arctic Earth, and yet livable. So this became the project in the book. And meanwhile, back on Earth, large corporations were coalescing. National governments were becoming less and less powerful in the context of global capitalism. And the environment was being thrashed to the point where there was an unexpected loss of the West Antarctic ice sheet, which is still a possibility, that raised sea level really quickly. So on Earth, things were going rather badly. On Mars, they were going rather well. And the people on Mars realized that Mars is just a tiny little blip on the human screen, and that if Mars was going to prosper, Earth needed to be prospering also. So there was a little bit of reverse engineering where the Martians tried to help Earth out. So there's about 200 years of human history in my Mars trilogy, and I tried to give a coherent account of that all the way through. And I think one of the reasons why my Mars books are popular is that people can read them and say, ah, our future can be interesting. It will not be free of problems. It will be neither dystopia nor utopia, but just more interesting history with accomplishments and new problems and the possibility of doing something rather interesting and marvelous, not just on Mars, but on Earth. Development of a permaculture, a culture on Earth that is actually in balance with the planet's biosphere, which is something we don't have now.
You wrote those books in the 1990s, pretty much coming off the heels of the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
A certain political and social situation, which, you know, brings me to something that I was thinking about with science fiction, is it, besides looking at the future, is science fiction also useful in telling you about about the time and, you know, about a way of analyzing the time in which a particular work was written in. And if you look at a book about Mars written in the 90s or one written in the 50s or, say, written in the 1890s, well, you may get something different that'll tell you about that time.
Yeah, that's right. Science fiction, once you get past the time that it attempted to describe, say with 1984, one of the first things you're going to say is, well, that was not great prediction. It didn't come out that way at all. And that's always going to be true, because one thing science fiction can't do is predict the absolutely real way that things are going to turn out. That's impossible. But what you can do when you look at old science fiction is say, this is what they used to think was possible. And if you look at science fiction from the 1950s, it's really interesting. Their fears, their hopes, they're absolutely revealed in a way that the mainstream literature, the domestic realism of the 1950s, can't convey to you hopes and fears as well as science fiction can. So that's one of the things that science fiction's doing right now, too. When you read, say, my book 2312 from last year, well, what it's really talking about is not 2312, but 2012. And it's doing both at the same time, I guess I should add, so that you get the interest of thinking about what could we be 300 years from now, but you're also getting a kind of a funhouse mirror of what we are like right now. So this is a neat little double vision that science fiction gives you.
In a way, are you conscious of this? Are you trying, when you're writing a work, are you trying to write for the ages and put something that will transcend the particular time you're in? And how would you do that anyway?
Well, I think that it's best. That would be hard. I think the thing to do is to try to write books that the people in your own time are going to find interesting and moving. And then what one would hope is that if you manage to do that properly, then that will remain permanently interesting. It'll be a story that anybody, anytime could read, and because of the characters, because of the things they go through. And so here you get to, say, the heart of novels, which is the life of the characters and the stories. So that a lot of times, talking at this level of abstraction that we are, you can begin to forget that novels always have to be stories about characters that you're engaged with. But that remains permanently true. The reason we love novels is because you're getting inside somebody else's head and you're living someone else's life. And it's vicarious, but it's powerful. You're really there. And when, like I say, if you read a lot of novels, you've lived 10,000 lives. It's rather wonderful because there's very few other ways to live 10,000 lives. So when you're writing science fiction, I think there's a kind of double thing going on. It's got to be a story that is interesting in its own terms, that the character's facing problems that the reader can understand and empathize with, and solutions too, one hopes. But then you've got that extra element that science fiction gives you, which is this historical element, which novels are very involved in. Novels are always about humans in history too. Like, what was it like to live during the French Revolution? Well, I can read Charles Dickens or Hilary Mantel, and I can find out what it was like. And then science fiction does the opposite thing, but it's equally interesting. What would it be like to live on Mars in the year 2200? Well, that can be experienced. It's a peculiar accomplishment, but it's not impossible because the human imagination is really good at imagining alternative states.
We're moving into our final quarter hour of Focus here on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions for science fiction author Kim Stanley Robinson at 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WILL, or you can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. I was wondering, you wrote, actually, I guess before you had actually published a novel, you wrote a book about the novels of Philip K. Dick.
Yeah, that's right.
Would you call him an influence as well?
Oh, sure. Philip K. Dick is a kind of a genius. He had a genius for capturing the way life felt during the craziness of the 1960s, 50s, 60s, and 70s is when he wrote. And that was when science fiction was only getting a penny a word. It was a kind of a subculture with a very small readership relative to the bestseller list. Not too many science fiction writers were hitting the bestseller list. At that point, it was probably ABC, Asimov, Bradbury, Clark. And Philip K. Dick was not one of those. It didn't go to D. So he struggled and wrote, oftentimes he would write five books in a year. And yet, they were brilliant because he had an ability to think like a poet. The images that he came up with, and we're now all familiar with them from the movies that have been made from his books, they managed to capture the way life felt during that crazy time.
And he did not intend originally to write science fiction. I don't know if your book touched on the non-science fiction work that he wrote in his early years.
No, it did. He was although those books at the time were all in boxes unpublished at Cal State Fullerton, and I went to Cal State Fullerton and I read them in manuscript out of their cardboard boxes. It was actually quite an exciting experience for me because these were lost novels. When he was young, he wanted to be like James Joyce, like Thomas Mann, or anybody that was really famous in literature at the time. He was an English major from Berkeley. It was a very important thing to him. So he wrote these 800-page realist novels about life in Berkeley, being a record store clerk and the like. And they were actually very turgid, very bad novels. He couldn't get them published for that reason. And there was a reason they weren't published. They were actually boring, bad novels. At the same time, he was writing these little science fiction adventures, 3, 4, 5, 6 a year, and they were getting published as paperback originals from places like Ace Books. And even Philip Dick himself didn't think much of these. He thought, well, this is just something that I can do to make money. And so he was in despair until he gave up writing those big, fat mainstream books, and that was when he wrote The Man in the High Castle, his first masterpiece, where the two halves of him came together.
You know, speaking about the role money plays in writing, let's take a call on line one from Tony in Champaign. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Yeah, good morning. I can't resist. I love Philip K. Dick, by the way. I can't resist asking your guest if he happens to know if any science fiction happened to include some innovative ideas about a money economy, doing away with that and doing something else instead. I was just curious because as I recall, I've never heard of such a thing, but I thought I'd ask you. I'm sure you know better than I, and I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Tony. Just from watching old Star Trek episodes, they seem to fluctuate back and forth on whether or not they use money. Mm-hmm. Have you seen any serious discussions of money and economics in science fiction?
Well, yes. And thanks, Tony, for that question, because it brings up something very important science fiction can do, which is to suggest that things could be different even in our culture. And that one is a crucial thing. I mean, economics, right now we're caught in an economic system in which people are suffering and the biosphere is suffering and things have to change. And yet it's very hard to imagine how to get from here to something better. So science fiction has done that too. And I guess the classic book to suggest would be The Dispossessed by Ursula K. Le Guin. And what she imagines is an Earth-like planet has a moon that is just barely habitable, and a group of revolutionary characters are kicked off to the moon where they establish an anarchist semi-utopia, an ambiguous utopia, as Le Guin calls it, and they're working in a post-capitalist, non-money economy, trying to get along by rules and by making what's needed and then not going too far into consumerist excess. And so then she examines that by having people go on trips back to the Earth planet that resembles ours and then up to this moon. So The Dispossessed changed the game for what economic science fiction was going to be like. It used to be before that it was more like reading a blueprint or reading an economics manual. And there are some pretty good old science fiction novels ranging back to Looking Backward from the Year 2000 by Edward Bellamy, which created progressive politics around the turn of the last century. This book was so popular there were clubs devoted to reading it, studying it, understanding its socialist political system, and instituting that in the real world. And the progressive movement in the early 20th century that meant so many important reforms in American politics comes out of a science fiction novel dedicated to economics. And this is a forgotten bit of history that's definitely real. Now, there was Mack Reynolds in the 1950s, but his books were kind of clunky. So when you get to Le Guin, you actually have a book that changed the nature of what utopian science fiction was going to be like. It was going to be exciting. It was going to be up to date. It was going to be well written and engaged. So that book is a classic. I would recommend that one first, and then you can kind of strand out from there. And, you know, I would like to say that in my Mars books, what happens on Mars is they try to get to post-capitalism and get away from the absolute dominance of money thinking to something that is a little more environmentalist, a little more sensitive to the realities of the world that you live in. And that gets back filled into Earth's own society in the Mars books. So I guess I would say I'm a kind of disciple of Ursula Le Guin in the sense that I come after her. She was hugely influential on a lot of us.
I was thinking it would be totally on the opposite part of the economic spectrum. Do the works of Ayn Rand, in terms of how they look at economics, maybe not science fiction, but at least making some speculation about economics?
Oh, yes. I would say Ayn Rand's work is science fiction. Well, obviously so. She puts scenarios in the future and then things happen. And her working philosophy was that if everybody was just pursuing their own selfish self-interests, it would be better for everybody. And if people weren't good at it, too bad for them. But for the people who were good at it, we would have an improvement of the species. It was a kind of an economic eugenics where it was survival of the fittest. And I think in many ways she's just completely wrong, that one of the reasons that human beings have prospered on this planet is that we're so good at cooperating and we're so good at helping each other, and that has always been a communal game. And this notion of the self above all is a really bad misreading of history and of human nature. But one of the things I've got to add is that science fiction is a great space to have these arguments, that you make these arguments in science fiction. And so there is an Ayn Rand, there is an Ursula Le Guin. I would say Le Guin's right, Ayn Rand's wrong. Read the texts and decide for yourself. And this is the reason that science fiction is so vibrant, is it has this political and economic element in it.
We're just about out of time. I'm sorry I don't have time to take the call from Helen from Urbana, but I do want to amplify the message that I'm told she's trying to get to us, and that's about Gene Wolfe being the golden guest of honor at this year's edition of ShambanaCon. That'll be a Thanksgiving weekend, I believe, at the Urbana Holiday Inn, if I have this right. Yes, that's the one, the Urbana Holiday Inn, and you can find more information about that at their website, ShambanaCon.com. .org. So as far as your influence, Gene Wolfe is still, he's in his 80s now, I believe, and he's still quite active.
Yeah, so he's publishing a new book in November that no doubt will be featured at this convention. I urge people to go. He's very witty guy. He has a sharp a thorny, hilarious mind. Gene Wolfe is a real star and worth going to see talk.
Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you very much, Kim Stanley Robinson. His newest book is Shaman, a novel of the Ice Age, and it's out now from Orbit Books. And at 11:30, just about half an hour from now, you can catch him at the Levis Faculty Center as part of a panel on science fiction and music. Welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. Today's show produced by Lindsay Moon, Jason Croft, our technical director. Sari Lesk is our intern. Monday on Focus, we delve into the past, not the prehistoric past, but the recent past in central Illinois. Our guests will include Bill Kemp of the Bloomington Pantograph. He has a new book out collecting several of his columns on local history, and that's part of Monday's show. This is Focus on WILL.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold and their newest AgriGold Giant 107-day A6408, available for 2014 in Roundup Ready and also VT Triple Pro Rib. More information on A6408, including yield and dry down data, is at AgriGold.com.
I'm Todd Gleason from Illinois Public Media, and with this update of the commodity markets, as they're trading at the CME Group in Chicago on this Friday morning, December contract at the CME at 4.53 1/4 is down 3.5 cents. The March corn at 4.65 3/4, 3 3/4 lower, and the May futures there at 4.74, down 3.5 cents. July corn at $4.80 1/4, 3.5 lower, and next year's December contract at 4.91, down 3.5 cents. The soybeans trading November November futures at $13.18.5, up a penny and three quarters. January 13.20.25, up 1.5 on the March contract, down a half. It's trading 12.97.5. The last trade for the May at 12.73.75, a 1.5 cents lower. And next year's November at $11.75.25, down 3.25 at this hour. The bean meal futures at 4.18.40 in the October, up $2. And the bean oil at 41.76, down 3 cents. The hard red winter wheat for the July contract at 7.13.75. A penny and three quarters higher, and the soft red winter wheat in the July harvest month at $6.82.25 is down one. Of course, you're listening to WILL and WILL-FM at HD Urbana. This is a broadcasting service to the College of Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. A quick look at the weather forecast as it comes from the National Weather Service. Sunny skies in 83 for the day. Tonight, low of 53 and clear skies. Sunny tomorrow in 83. Showers on Saturday evening and 80% chance of coverage, a 59-degree low, and on Sunday, sunny skies in 75, Sunday evening, clear and 50, and we'll start the work week with sunny skies in 75 degrees on Monday, and then Monday night, clear and 54. This is Illinois Public Media. From W.